No graceful way to do that. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case to be submitted with oral argument this afternoon and several more that will be submitted on briefs after your oral argument when we conference. I'm sure y'all probably know us, but I'll introduce Judge Sue Walker again on my right, Justice Sue Walker, and Justice Bob McCoy on my left, and I'm Justice Ann Gardner. So happy to have you over here from Dallas today. And I will ask Bonnie to call the case and introduce the lawyers. Would you like to begin?
May it please the court, Julia Pendery on behalf of Jinwei Chen.
Counsel.
The restricted appeal was created as a fallback to protect defendants in the exact type of situation Mr. Chen finds himself in. When your name is dropped into a pleading as an agent, someone calls you an agent of the bad actor, and you find out about a default judgment at a point where you cannot go file a motion for new trial and explain things, you need this remedy of restricted appeal, which, as we know, takes us to error on the face of the record. As we know from a default, the defendant admits facts properly pleaded, doesn't admit legal conclusions, doesn't admit causation of damages and amount of the damages. So in my brief, I have discussed a number of errors on the face of the record. I think perhaps the most efficient one to seek remand, reversal and remand on this, is the issue of agency. And this came up more in the reply brief in terms of the fact that my opponent characterized agency as a fact that was admitted by the pleadings. Actually, a finding of principal-agent relationship is an issue of law that cannot be presumed. It must be decided based on the factors of evidence of the right to control, to assign what they're doing, and to control the manner in which the person does it for you. There's absolutely no evidence in this record that Angela Fowler or her company Region Realty were agents for Mr. Chen. In fact, Mr. Chen's name is mentioned nowhere except in a petition that says Angela Fowler acted as agent for Mr. Chen at all times.
Is there anywhere in the record where it says that he was the owner or landlord?
I believe that is alleged. I'm not sure. I think it's in the default judgment. I am not positive that it's actually alleged in the petition. And if that would be potentially a fact that could be alleged, although I would question whether even ownership is a legal conclusion. excuse me. Thus, I'm arguing there's no evidence to support the legal conclusion of an agency relationship in this entire $14,000 default judgment on an unreturned application deposit of $1,500 is based on this vicarious liability. In addition, I think there are a number of other errors on the face of the record. Most of the facts, quote unquote, in the that support the default judgment were in the affidavit of Mrs. Johnson, most of which is very conclusory statements, no facts to support them, legal conclusions, and therefore not competent evidence. And in the opening brief, I take apart a number of those that are just leaping to conclusions with nothing to support the facts. excuse me. The first point out of our gate was the one satisfaction rule, and I think the law is quite clear that you cannot get multiple sets of damages for the same injury. Yes, plaintiff alleged she paid an application deposit of $1,500. There's some liquidated actual damages.
What damages would you say could be recovered under these circumstances? Treble damages under the DTPA plus attorney's fees?
Treble damages if you had some evidence of the intent necessary.
Okay, we're not going to that. I'm just saying, what okay. damages could you theoretically recover?
Theoretically.
45 plus 5?
Right. Actual, right.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks.
That's your most that you could recover under that one. And there are a number of combinations, although some of these have, well, none of them have evidence of the intent element that supports the exemplary or punitives. But there are a number of different combinations, but you can't have actual damages for contract and fraud and then pick from column B with punitive damages or statutory damages on all these other things. And I think Appley admits that it is kind of a double dipping here and asks you to take the $1,500 plus attorney's fees plus whatever way you can get to the highest number of damages and affirm on that. The law doesn't do that. And I've cited some cases in the reply brief that say even if you've proved one type of damages, if all these others there's no proof of or it, you can't tell what's what, means you have to send all the damages back. It does not mean you have to send the liability back. I realize that, although I think there are quite a few errors in the face of the record as to the liability findings. But the whole mishmash of all the possible damages that could have been pleaded is error on the face of the record. excuse me. I have mentioned in greater detail in the briefs the whole analysis of what level of mental intent proof is necessary. It seems to be different on every one of these statutory damages, treble damages, all of that. There's no evidence of any of it. And again, the default does not admit damages or causation of those damages because causation is completely linked up into the intent element necessary to get to punitive damages.
Wouldn't intent be admitted by the default?
It is not. The cases I've cited say you have to have proof of the actual mental state, and that is not admitted by the default. You have to have some evidence of a mental state. Now, I think the other side is going to argue the fact that Ms. Fowler says, I'm not returning your application deposit because you said you might not be moving and you said you thought we wouldn't have the house ready on time, that that is somehow evidence to support a mental state of falsity, deception, bad faith, intent to never return the application deposit, et cetera. Of course, I go back to there's no evidence she's our agent, but I also don't think that rises to the level of the mental intent necessary to impose all these exemplary damages. So, one of the more interesting things to me was one of the smaller things, except that it's the actual damages that then all these added penalties add on to, and that is that, yes, the default admits facts, not necessarily legal conclusions like there was a contract, but actually the evidence submitted by the plaintiffs shows there was not a contract. Now, to me, that was an interesting question. If you have things admitted in a pleading, but your own evidence affirmatively shows that's wrong, which controls? I certainly think your own affirmative evidence that shows that's wrong controls. Not only is there no language at all, offer, acceptance, any of that stuff, what there is an online notification that the $1,500 Mrs. Johnson paid to Paylease Inc. was received. Okay. Zero of those offer, acceptance, et cetera, elements of the other stuff, but even if Region accepts, what is the contract? The application says this is not a contract. They will, if a rental agreement is signed later, excuse me, that term is nowhere, if a lease is signed later, then that might be the agreement. It also mentions the attached application deposit agreement, which isn't attached. So there's no evidence in the record of an actual formation of a contract. One of the other things.
Why do we need a contract to get to DTPA?
You don't. But no, you don't. But the judgment recites that the actual damages are for breach of contract and fraud. But then we add DTPA damages and property code damages and theft liability act. Speaking of the property code damages, in my opening brief, I attempted to guess what section of the property code was alleged to have been violated. Bending over backwards, thought what I had was the one they must have been alleging. It wasn't. They've come back and said, oh, no, it's a different one. Well, they can't get a judgment on something they didn't allege other than just the property code. So that's another one out there. excuse me. There are errors of fact here, the insufficiency of the evidence to support the things. There are errors of law here, award of punitive damages when there is no evidence to support the requisite intents. This agency finding when there is no evidence to support an agency relationship.
Award of property. I have a question. So you're not saying that you can never have a default judgment in a cause of action that alleges a malicious intent or some intent other than ordinary negligence, right?
You'd have to put on some evidence.
All right, so it's undisputed there was no evidentiary hearing in this case.
Correct, but there was an affidavit, and
okay.
You can submit affidavits.
And you said that, I believe in your argument, you said that the judgment was based on breach of contract and fraud and not on DTPA, but it looks to me like the final paragraph of the first page of the judgment reflects that the trial court did base the judgment on DTPA.
It is extremely confusing, yes. It says in the beginning, here's what the actual damages are. And then in the end, it says, and you violated everything, and therefore, you get your damages.
But no, on the last paragraph of the first page, it said, on good and sufficient evidence presented to the court finds that defendant Chin is liable to plaintiff the Deceptive Trade Practices Act in the additional amount of $3,000.
Right, that's the punitives. Are we at the bottom of the first page?
Yes.
Then it goes on and says the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act in the additional amount of $3,000. Looks like a word was left out or something.
Right, it starts with.
It says they're unliquidated damages, so I'm not sure I'm seeing how that's exemplary damages.
Well, I am lumping exemplary punitive being all of these statutory damages that are based on bad intent, deception, falsity, all of those. They are all statutory penalty damages. What I'm talking about is that the paragraph above says, here's the liquidated damages, $1,500, fraud and breach of contract. Liquidated damages under, and this is an interesting, this property code provision calls it, this additional $1,000 calls it liquidated damages, but again, it has that kind of a requisite mental intent finding. Then it starts putting the others on all the unliquidated damages. And I may be misleading in just trying to lump together and call the unliquidated all these ones that require some finding of bad intent. But they all do, so. excuse me, I will just sum up to ask that you reverse the trial court judgment in its entirety and remand for an actual trial for Mr. Chin. And release the cash deposit, and it is in the record that he was forced to pay approximately $11,000 in cash to avoid the seizure of this home, which was underway. So, thank you.
Thank
Y'all, as a point of interest, sat down with your "we can work this out" face on and talked to each other about this?
Yes.
Anytime recently?
We had a conversation about it at the early stages.
What about mediation at this point?
Yeah, what about the later stages?
Would there be any possibility or interest?
Can I ask him one question?
Well, sure.
Sure.
Probably not. In all honesty.
Refresh my memory. What is the status of the case against the realtor?
That's what I was just asking.
Can I speak?
Since the recovery against the realtor, one satisfaction rule, all that kind of stuff.
Since the case was severed, essentially.
It's moribund?
We're waiting.
Pending. Okay, right. Thank you, Ms. Pendry.
You're welcome.
And so, Appellee Council, are you ready? Elliot Roth.
May it please the court. Elliot Roth on behalf of Appellees. In this case, there's actually a multitude of legal standards that appellant has to overcome since this was a default judgment and a restricted appeal. And two that weren't discussed yet are the legal and factual sufficiency of the judgment and the pleadings. And as regarding legal sufficiency, the case law says that the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the judgment, and the court indulges every reasonable inference to support it. Anything more than a scintilla of evidence is legally sufficient. And so if there's even a scintilla of evidence of a breach of contract, of causation, of damages, of Texas Theft Liability Act, the DTPA, for instance, that is legally sufficient. And as far as factual sufficiency is concerned, the judgment is only overturned if the evidence is contrary, that it is so overwhelming that the judgment should be set aside. Well, the only real evidence in this case supports the judgment. So there's no evidence to the contrary. There was a breach of contract. There was a violation of the property code and the DTPA. And so even if this court holds that, well, there's not sufficient evidence of fraud in this case, the harmless error rule would come into play, and that's rule of appellate procedure 44.1, which says that the appellate court reverses and remands for the maximum amount of damages. And so if this court says, well, we don't see fraud in this case, but we do see a breach of contract, and we see a violation of the property code, the court does not reverse and have a new trial or reverse and say you need to have another hearing on the damages. The court just figures out what the damages are from the judgment, which were clearly outlined in different parts, $3,000 for the DTPA, $1,500 in liquidated damages, and says that's the judgment. And so there's these various hurdles for the appellant to overcome in this case. And as the appellant said, all the factual allegations in the pleading are admitted. And just going to agency first, since that was the first issue that was discussed, the pleadings show that Ms. Fowler was acting as the agent for appellant. In the pleadings and in the affidavit of Angela Fowler, it is alleged that Jinhui Chen is the owner of the home. That's on court record page 104. And in fact, there was a letter written by Region Realty the appellees, Ms. Johnson, that says, we've accepted the application, we took the application deposit, we sent it to Mr. Chen, and we're communicating with you regarding this application deposit that you said you wanted returned. And so that, in addition to it being alleged that Ms. Fowler was the realtor of the home, on page 104 of the court record, the receipt of payment that states the property management company is Region Realty, And that is on page 61. It's clear from the record that the purpose of this relationship was an agency relationship with regards to the application deposit and accepting the application deposit and entering into this application to rent the property. And so, of course, there can be agency relationships as to different tasks. We never allege that it was the agent, Region Realty was the agent to sell the property, just with regards to this application and application deposit. And so there are facts on the record. As far as causation, Texas law has stated as recently as 1999 in the Texas Commerce Bank, which is cited in our brief, says where a party states that his injuries are a result of the accident and nothing refutes this testimony, the evidence as to damages is sufficient both legally and factually. And so there was an allegation that my damages are $1,500 because I submitted this application fee and the application fee wasn't, or application deposit, was not returned to me. In the Texas Property Code, it defines an application deposit as a amount of money that is refundable on demand if certain requirements are met. And so, and I'll just address the Texas Property Code because I believe that's actually the cause of action that would, that the appellee would recover the most damages because it's essentially treble damages, attorney's fees plus $100. It's a difference of $100 from the DTPA. And in the property code, all that's required is, well, the elements to get you to the damages are deemed rejection. And deemed rejection is no notice or acceptance of applicant on or before the seventh day of submission of the application or acceptance of the application deposit. That's in the property code 92.352. The record shows that on August 15th, page 67 of the record shows that on August 15th, Jody Johnson sent an email that said, I'd like an update on my application deposit. I haven't received any confirmation that I was accepted as an applicant. And through phone calls, the record shows, she also called and said, I'm concerned that this property isn't going to be livable when I get there. It's not going to be repaired. And so I might not be moving into the area because this property won't be ready. And in return, for the first time, she found out that Region Realty and Mr. Chen were saying, well, if you back out of this lease, we're not returning this application deposit. That was agreed to all along. Even though we previously accepted your application, and we previously accepted the application deposit, and in the application, it states that we are keeping the property open to other possible renters to accept other application deposits. And it's only when we give you acceptance, or when we notify that you've accepted, that we'll keep this $1,500 and you can move into the property. And so, circling back around to this property code and whether or not that specific property section was mentioned, the 92.352 as opposed to 92.3515, I believe. And appellant is saying that, well, they didn't mention the specific particular section of the property code. But Texas law is clear that when you're reviewing these cases, the appellate court, quote, upholds conclusions on appeal if the judgment can be sustained on any legal theory supported by the evidence. That's a Texas Appeals First District of Houston case from 2005. And so what that protects against, if someone alleges all the factual elements of a case and submits an affidavit that says, we were rejected as applicants, we requested our refund back, they did not refund it, and then the court cites 82.3, which is the wrong provision, the appellant wouldn't have the remedy to say, well, the trial court misquoted the relevant section, we're going to have to go back and have this whole trial again. If all the elements of the claim are enumerated, and the Texas Property Code is specifically mentioned, then this court would uphold that decision.
I have a question.
Yes.
You mentioned that you thought that the property code cause of action gave you the greatest recovery. So can you address whether or not you're entitled to recover additionally under these other theories that seem to be based on the same act?
Right. I believe that, and in our brief we touched on it, that the Stewart title case, it's pretty confusing. It seems to say that you can't double recover for liquidated or actual damages, but you might be able to double up or recover from different defendants on exemplary damages or statutory penalties. And what the Stewart title case said was you actually apply this credit, they called it, pre-trebling of damages. It was discussing the DPA, DTPA, and it said if your maximum amount of damages are, I believe in that case it was $600,000 that you could possibly recover, and you settle with one defendant for $400,000, you can still recover $200,000 of exemplary or statutory penalties from that other defendant, because we want to give the maximum benefit to the plaintiff, because that's the legislative intent of punitive damages. And that would, they touched on encouraging settlement, encouraging parties to agree, and encouraging maximum damages.
But I'm talking about the awards under different causes of action.
Right, and I believe there, Appley does concede that there does appear to be a violation of the election of remedies rule as opposed to one satisfaction, which is different defendants.
Okay, so what's your position on the amount of judgment that you should receive?
Well, we believe that what was proved in the record, and, well, in theory, what provides the most damages is the Texas property code.
Right. So assume you get that.
Right. That would be that plus attorney's fees.
Right. So it would be?
$100.
It would be $4,500 plus $5,000 plus $100?
Correct. Correct, Your Honor.
As opposed to without the $100.
Right. That's really the only difference. And to recover under the Texas property code, what's required is a showing of bad faith, and that's not very specifically defined, but again, the evidence shows that Appley and appellant had communications about moving into this home, and the Appley was coming from out of state, and the Appley submitted this application deposit on the assumption that the house was going to be continued to be shown to other parties, and the landlord could agree with another party to come in and rent the house, and she would have her $1,500 returned because she wouldn't be moving to that house. And when she expressed concern that the property wouldn't be repaired in time, the landlord, through the agent, said, well, that application wasn't actually an application that we accept, even though we've previously accepted it and accepted the application deposit. Well, that actually is not that's not our form. And so we took the house off the market, and we accepted the non-refundable application deposit. And since you're concerned that the house might not be repaired, and therefore you may not be moving into the house, we're going to not refund it because you're the one canceling the supposed lease agreement, which hadn't even been entered into. And so that is clearly more than a scintilla of evidence of bad faith. And the same letter on court record page 63 states that we forwarded this application deposit to the landlord, Mr. Chen, who's also the owner. And so we're not going to be returning it. And taking that as a fact, because it's an exhibit and referenced in the original petition, and taking the fact that the appellees relied on the previous representations and believed that it was refundable, and the multiple communications back and forth, for instance, Region Realty acting as the realtor and accepting the application deposit as the management company, that they were holding themselves out to be the agent, and Mr. Chen was the landlord. And so all of these taken into consideration show bad faith, as is the intent element of that. And the last thing I wanted to touch on was the attorney's fees. And the attorney's fees, appellant has challenged the attorney's fees, saying that they were not segregated for each defendant. But that's not what the rule says. The rule says, with regards to claims as to different defendants, this is in the Tony Gullo Motors case, which is the Texas Supreme Court in 2004, I believe. States that, well, first it analyzes and says, not all fees need to be precisely allocated. If you're advancing a petition against multiple defendants on the same facts, there's no way an attorney can say, well, I spent 5 minutes drafting this paragraph for fraud, which is not recoverable as attorney's fees. And so The court stated that it's only if fees relate, quote, solely to a claim for which such fees are unrecoverable that a claimant must segregate. When legal services advance both recoverable and unrecoverable claims, they need not be segregated. And so this is precisely the situation we have here. There was a petition filed, one petition, which all the facts were the same, the damages were the same, and the only portion was about four paragraphs, which was the language for fraud. It's actually fraud by non-disclosure. And so under this Tony Gullo Motors case, clearly you can't segregate out those fees. It's just not possible. And in the affidavit of attorney's fees, it says, the fees I've included here are the fees recoverable under Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code 38 or the Texas Property Code, and cites the provision, or under the Texas Theft Liability Act, which also provides for attorney's fees. And so the affidavit clearly says these are the fees that were spent to advance these theories under which fees are recoverable. And for these reasons, we would ask that the court reverse and render for the maximum amount of damages proven by the record. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Pendry, you have a rebuttal?
Just a couple minutes, unless the court has questions. My basic point is the evidence doesn't support the judgment. The factual and legal sufficiency standards, when applied, show that the trial judge finding legal theories or finding liability based on the evidence put in front of him and the missing evidence is clearly wrong and manifestly unjust, and I think we satisfy that standard. A couple of miscellaneous things. Nowhere in Ms. Fowler's letter that is in the record does it say anything about Mr. Chen, especially not, I gave the money to Mr. Chen, or Mr. Chen knows a thing in the world about this whole transaction. So I'm actually glad counsel brought up the fact that the Texas Property Code additional damages requires proof of bad faith. Even if you, for the sake of argument, said that Fowler was Chen's agent, I don't think you see bad faith in Fowler saying, you know, you told us you weren't coming. You told us that you thought the house wouldn't be ready, though we said it would. Whatever. Anyway, and, you know, every time I read the Tony Gullo case, I get something new out of it, and I just kind of feel like you need to take it to every argument. And so one thing I see that doesn't work here, not only is failing to segregate between different clients, but you still have to say, my fees cannot be segregated between the fraud and the others because the same amount of time was incurred, or they're inextricably intertwined, or whatever your statement is. So, I think we did get somewhat of the concession on Stewart Title. It's about the injury, and there's just one way to go on the injury, and they're picking Texas Property Code, which again was not pleaded. So, unless the court has further questions.
Do you represent the realty company?
Oh, no, I don't.
I assume that you did not, but I wanted to ask.
No.
And y'all could go out into the lobby and talk some more if you chose to.
I'll choose to, but I can't go outside the record, so won't tell you anything further. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your arguments and your briefs. Good job, and your case is submitted. You're excused, and we'll stand adjourned for the afternoon. Getting my papers together. Thank you for traveling all the way over here to Fort Worth.
Nice to have you. Oh no.
Come back and see us.